You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
Over three decades ago, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act was created. It requires institutions that receive federal funding, such as museums and universities, to return human remains, sacred objects, and other items of cultural significance to federally recognized tribes. However, even now, in 2024, the struggle continues when it comes to the return of these ancestral remains and revered belongings. This slowness in repatriation can be found across the country and here in the Bay Area as well. So why is it taking so long to comply with these rules? Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. For a broader look at all of this, we're going to start the conversation off with Logan Jaffe, newsletter reporter at ProPublica. She worked on the news organization's repatriation project. Logan Jaffe, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation on In-Depth.
Thanks for having me.
So for context here, for those who might not be familiar with what all we're going to be talking about, I think it's important to look at the prevalence of museums and other institutions and what they have done when it comes to indigenous Native American tribes and their people, their ancestors, their items. How much was taken from tribes and people, you know, back with the mid 1800s, maybe earlier than that, but how long was this going on?
Sure. I mean, it's, you know, there are, it's hard to give you an exact number, but I would say like it, what has been reported to the federal government and the National Park Service by museums and federal agencies and universities that have received federal money, it's in the tens of thousands of ancestral remains taken from grave sites all across the country, spanning from, who knows, like as early as, you know, the early 1800s, perhaps even before that, up until, you know, the 1970s, even up until like 1990, when the federal law, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act passed. And, you know, when you think about the magnitude of how many indigenous gravesites were destroyed and looted by, you know, amateur archaeologists, pot hunters, but also by, you know, really concerted efforts by some of the most prestigious museums in the country, such as the American Museum of Natural History in New York and the Field Museum in Chicago. University of California, Berkeley, we reported, had some of the largest numbers of ancestral remains still in their collections as of last year. So it is quite shocking to, and I'm still shocked by it after reporting on it for nearly 2 years, just to think about the magnitude of what was taken from Indigenous communities, by who and why.
Well, and you mentioned the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, which came in 1990. But, you know, before then, was this something that the federal government just didn't really think or care about?
Not necessarily. You get, even with things like, you know, the ARPA. I'm forgetting exactly what it stands for, but there have been laws in place federally and also statewide that, you know, that the law is intended to protect and preserve archaeological resources is what, you know, kind of government quotes for what they would call indigenous belongings and ancestral remains. So it was very much thought about by the federal government as, and the National Park Service in particular, as archaeological resources that are owned by governments on behalf of their citizens. So it is thought of as not necessary. It was for a long time before NAGPRA, you know, thought of this, the responsibility of archaeologists in particular, who are often going in and excavating sites, perhaps, you know, if they were under threat of being destroyed by big construction projects, to go in and sort of preserve and save these human remains from destruction. But on the other hand, you know, they would get sometimes funneled to museums where they would be sort of forgotten about for a long time until 1990, when NAGPRA really, I mean, it made it federal law for places like museums and curators to consult with tribal nations about what should happen with these ancestral remains and funerary items and cultural items in their collections.
Well, you know, what's the compliance been like since that act was put into motion? Has there been compliance? I get the feeling that there hasn't been as much as one would have hoped.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. When the law passed in 1990, you know, there's been a variety of estimates, but, you know, one estimate was that everything would be, you know, repatriated or completed within 10 years. And, you know, it's 2024 now. And just at the end of last year, at the end of 2023, did the entire NAGPRA program report that it is finally under the halfway mark of completing the NAGPRA process. So there's still like tens of thousands of ancestral remains that, you know, need to be consulted on with or between museums and universities and tribes. But it has taken way longer than I think, you know, that the reporting shows anybody has thought. It's been more than 30 years, and it's just under the halfway mark of what is knowable.
Well, yeah, that was going to be, you know, kind of, you know, my next question was going to be, you know, what has hindered this act from really moving things forward for the indigenous people and tribes that are, you know, wanting to get these ancestors back, remains back, these items that are of cultural importance. And I mean, it sounds like obviously there's a lot to go through. There's a lot of communication that has to happen in order to know where things go and who to communicate with and all of this. Is any of it reliant on like funding or anything like that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, funding is a big part of this. You know, a lot of museums and even tribal representatives that my colleague Mary Hudetz and I have spoken with over the past 2 years, you know, they do point to the lack of funding. There are federal grants specifically for repatriation and consultation. But, you know, probably the most agreeable thing about NAGPRA is that there's not enough funding for it. You know, so that's one aspect of it. But another aspect of it is even the funding itself doesn't, or it hasn't paid, you know, sources have told us it doesn't pay enough attention to the fact that so many tribes for so long have been very under-resourced and are trying to do things like run their own governments and serve their own communities on a day-to-day basis, in addition to doing all of this very intensive NAGPRA work, in addition to things like Section 106 requests and, you know, other tribal historic preservation responsibilities for their own communities. So that's a big aspect of this, that it's a disproportionate amount of an ask. And for a long time, you know, museums have also lagged in how proactive they have been at reaching out to tribes, at doing meaningful consultation, and trying to, you know, approach talking with tribal communities from a sense of genuinely wanting and believing that they should return their own belongings and ancestors, like to the tribal nations to whose lands many of these ancestral remains were very violently taken from. So there, that's one part of it. And, you know, my colleague Mary Hudetz and I have been reporting on what is now sort of changing, but there was this part of the law called culturally unidentifiable. And how we found that it was being used is it was being a bit exploited by some museums by saying things like, hey, you know, all of these ancestors in our collections were taken, you know, and excavated from a time where we don't really have records of, you know, how old they actually might be, or we don't have a clear understanding of which tribe they should really belong to. And we can't be 100% certain about, you know, making an affiliation between these very old ancestral remains and a modern day tribal community. So we're going to label these culturally unidentifiable and delay repatriating those ancestral remains. So now there are new regulations, and that, you know, designation is no longer in effect, and we're still seeing how that might play out.
Yeah, that, I was curious to know where these new regulations fit in and what they would do. And from your perspective, from this work that you've done in investigating this, what do you think the reticence is on the side of the museums and other higher institutions that are dragging their feet in this respect?
Yeah, I think it depends on which museums and which institutions are dragging their feet at this point. And, you know, our reporting really focused on the top 10 to 20 museums that had the most unrepatriated ancestral remains and funerary items. And, you know, why some museums we found were dragging their feet. It, for one reason, you know, is because there were a lot of research incentives for these institutions to do like a DNA analysis and try different DNA extraction techniques from these very old human remains, for example, or, you know, researching different funerary items. And also, you know, a lot, or I shouldn't say a lot because it's hard to know for sure, but a good number of funerary items and other cultural items that belong to tribal nations have been on display in museums for a long time. And, you know, like I live in Chicago, and I'm thinking about, for example, the Field Museum, which very recently had to or chose to cover up with butcher paper and painter's tape dozens and dozens of exhibits and displays that had previously shown, you know, like several like tools and items from grave sites. It was part of their big Ancient Americas exhibit. And so that was a draw for, you know, visitors to the museum for a very long time, was seeing these, you know, old, you know, what they call Mississippian era or Hopewell, you know, cultural collections, without really acknowledging the origins of how and when and why and the conditions of violent, you know, removal and displacement that Indigenous communities were going through at around the times that many of these collections were being excavated by the same institutions that continued to display them.
In Depth will return after a moment. Now we turn to Carrie Malloy, Assistant Professor of Native American and Indigenous Studies at San Jose State University. He is an enrolled member of the Yurok tribe and is of Karuk descent. Carrie Malloy, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation on KCBS's In Depth.
Oh, thank you for having me today.
Tell us a little bit about what you teach and discuss at San Jose State.
So I teach in the Native American Indigenous Studies program here at San Jose State. It's a new program, and we focus on understanding the relationship between tribes and the United States by looking at history, federal Indian policy, state Indian policy. We look at literature, we look at oral tradition, we examine traditional ecological knowledge, all to understand that relationship that has developed between tribes in the United States since the nation's founding and where we sit today with that and how that can help move society forward.
Well, and I think the topic of repatriation probably has a footing there in the conversations that you are having on a scholastic and educational level. From your perspective, then, in this larger conversation, you know, how does repatriation fit into what you do?
Repatriation fits into the program here and what I do in that if we look at the larger history of the United States and westward expansion and the advancement of science, what we see is as the United States progressed from the East Coast to the West Coast, there were several massacres. There were conflicts between tribes and settlers, and there were mass graves that were put together. In many cases, shortly after those graves were prepared and the bodies buried, doctors from local communities would go out and remove those remains and use them for scientific purposes. So in one sense, you have to understand that history to understand how some of these objects actually have made it into museum and university collections. As you get out here to California, what you begin to see is the development of the discipline of anthropology and archaeology. And once again, you have a series of grave robbings that began to take place. One of the most notable ones would have been in Eureka, California, up in Humboldt County on the island, what was known as Indian Island, but is actually Tulawat to the Wiat people. After the massacre there in 1863, the mass graves were used by a local high school as a living laboratory in removing human remains and artifacts and putting them into collections. So what we do around repatriation is we talk about in many ways how those items came into be in possession of museums or universities or private collectors and what it means to tribal people to have those items returned to them and reburied properly or put back into use or however the tribe sees fit to use those.
One thing that I have seen mentioned in the recent past, at least on the viewpoint from some people within the university system, is that these remains and items, you know, being removed is somehow detrimental to research or educational purposes that they were being utilized for. And that got me, you know, kind of curious. Is there some sort of space where universities can continue to have information or teachings, but that actually works with Native and Indigenous tribes so that they are being respected and honored as well? I mean, is that something that there's any merit to?
I think there is merit to the idea of tribes and universities working together in keeping some remains that the tribe feels should remain in use for scientific purposes. But those have to be done by consent. There has to be a conversation between the campuses and the tribes on how those remains are going to be used, how the scientific findings for those are going to be used. You have the Human Genome Project, which has been working to map the human genome for the last couple of decades. They've actually begun to engage with indigenous groups around the world and talking about how they can use the data taken from indigenous people, but protect it in a way that tribes and indigenous populations around the world can say, this is how it should be used. You know, we have a long history globally of Native people being looked at as a resource and being owned and as something to be extracted from. So if we can turn the tables a little bit and then have that conversation about how do we work together. Now, some tribes will say, yes, go ahead, and we agree that these certain items and remains may be used, but these other ones may not be. But to wholesale say that this is hurting science without having the conversation isn't really an accurate thing. You have to be willing to engage in that conversation and also accept that, you know, no one's going to get everything they want out of that. Researchers aren't going to get everything. Tribes are going to hold their stand and say, look, this is what we want. This is what the law says, but this is how we can work together. And those conversations are happening. There are tribes that are engaged with conversations right now with universities about how to continue to maintain their collections or keep certain items for research. And there are other tribes saying, no, we want everything back until we've had time to really process what this means and make sure it follows our cultural protocols. So yeah, there is room for it. You just have to be willing to have that conversation.
Well, I would imagine that the first steps for many, or in the eyes of many, would have to come from the institutions themselves, you know, stepping further into repatriation activities, being more communicative and engaging with tribes, which, you know, I've had some conversations where they're saying that funding and resources are hard to come by. But some universities and colleges have been able to really step up into this situation a bit more fully. From your knowledge base, where does San Jose State stand when it comes to repatriation activities?
So where San Jose State stands currently in the repatriation process is we do have a NAGPRA coordinator on staff. She is a faculty member who is partially within the provost office and partially within the Department of Anthropology. And San Jose State is in compliance and has completed its full audit and is working directly with the tribal groups that have items and remains in the university collection. So they're working through that. Where the university is running into a problem, and this is going to be an issue across the state, is NAGPRA is a federal law. And under the federal law, items can only be returned to federally recognized tribes. CalNAGPRA is a state law, and CalNAGPRA requires that items be returned to federally recognized tribes and non-recognized tribes that are listed on the list of tribal entities from the California Indian Heritage Commission. So where everybody sits right now, and particularly for San Jose State, because most of the tribes whose remains and cultural items are here are from what we non-federally recognized tribes. So right now where everybody is at is trying to figure out, how do you navigate the discrepancy between federal and state law? How do you comply with state law without violating federal law? That is one of the cruxes. The relationship that our NAGPRA coordinator has built with each of the tribes in the area and working with them is very, very strong and very, very positive. I can't overemphasize that, because she's gone out of her way to work with each group to say, here is what we have. How do we properly handle these? How do we maintain these? The tribes have been invited in to view the items and carry out their own cultural practices around those. Also, we have access has been severely restricted at the tribe's request not to allow research to occur on those. So we're in a really good position in compliance with the spirit of the law. Where we are stuck right now is waiting for the state and the federal government to reconcile their intentions. So once again, this is an unintended consequence of a good act. Is when you have two conflicting laws, you put the very people who are responsible for carrying it out in a precarious situation. And that is being worked out throughout the state right now. And I'm hoping to see that come to some form of resolution in the near future.
We started off this conversation about, you know, the work that you do and how repatriation falls into that bigger, broader conversation of closure, of healing, of respect being given. What is your viewpoint on let's say we get to a space where all institutions have complied with NAGPRA, and there is that sense that tribes, Native and Indigenous tribes, are able to bring a sense of closure and of coming home of these remains and items that are culturally important and significant to them. How far do you think that would take the healing process that really stems so far back? It's hard to contemplate sometimes.
It is hard to contemplate. And, you know, full compliance with both NAGPRA and CalNAGPRA will mean a lot. And partially that's because if we look at the practices that are used to heal deeply divided societies, so societies who have experienced mass atrocity events or racial division, the responsibility for healing generally falls on the victimized group. They're the ones who become responsible for memorialization. They are the ones who become responsible for beginning the healing process to keep it moving. This situation reverses that. This places the responsibility on the institutions that benefited from these atrocities to actually do something meaningful that is not performative, but actually has a meaning to it and a practice. So this begins to build relationships between both universities, museums, and tribes, and it begins to move us in a direction of cooperation. How do we represent the history of this country? How do we study the history of this country in a manner that is responsible and truthful so that we don't do this again, so that we learn from the past and actually put into practice those lessons? And I think the other thing that it does is it actually recognizes something. It recognizes that there have been, since time immemorial, Native people on this continent, and we are part of the current society. We are not in the past, we are in the present. And that helps reconcile that and bring everybody home so that we can all begin to move forward and begin to, you know, really move past all these divisions that have separated us for so long.
You can hear in-depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In-Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In-Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.